Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll tell you all about the Ohio Food and Farm Association's annual conference coming up next week. Nicolette Hahn-Nyman will be one of the keynote speakers at the event. We'll talk to her about the work she's doing to improve food and farming systems in the U.S. Later in the program, reinvention stories, and this week, WISO turned 55 years old. We'll look to the past with the woman who's leading the station's charge into the future, our general manager, Nina Ellis. Up first, let's look at this week in the news. Officials at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base say that under guidance from the Department of Defense, they have begun planning for a potential reduction of 15% of their operating budget as a result of sequestration. In a press conference Thursday, Colonel Cassie Barlow told reporters that a furlough of civilian employees isn't out of the question, but it would be a last resort.
We don't want to have to go through it. We really don't. Furlough is tough on everybody. It's tough on all of our civilian employees who are hardworking Americans and are doing a great job and have been working many, many years for the government. It's tough on our civilian employees. It's tough on our military. And it's also tough on our contractors. So it's absolutely our goal to not have to go through a furlough. So we'll go through the planning in hopes that we don't have to actually implement our plan.
Barlow says they'll begin by planning and identifying mission-critical operations at Wright-Patt. One of those operations, readiness.
So we need to continue to fight the wars downrange. We need to continue to send to deploy people. And the way in which we do that is by preparing them and making sure our airmen are ready. And then, of course, reintegrating them when they get back. That's also a very important thing that we do, important part of our mission. So we want to try to not affect that part of our mission, but that'll all come through the planning to see which employees we have that are impacted.
Colonel Barlow contends that any amount of reductions will have a significant impact. The base has about 13,000 civilian employees. That's about 60% of their workforce. And she says there are 50 to 60,000 retirees that live in the Miami Valley and depend on base services. Wright-Patt is required to provide a 30-day notification in the event of a furlough, so no cuts to personnel are expected before April, if at all. The Air Force Base has already implemented reductions ahead of the automatic spending cuts. President Obama and Congress have until March 1st to reach a deal. Earlier this week was National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness Day, and the Centers for Disease Control say that although blacks make up just 14% of the nation's population, they account for about 44% of all new HIV infections. Ohio is reporting even more alarming statistics. Blacks make up just 12% of the population, but account for almost half, 49% of new HIV infections. So health organizations around the country and in Ohio mobilize to encourage populations of color to get educated, get tested, get involved, and get treated. Tyler Termeer is director of Ohio AIDS Coalition, a division of AIDS Resource Center Ohio. He says after 30-plus years of progress on treatment and awareness, the stigma attached to HIV/AIDS is still prevalent.
Because HIV has for such a long time been tied to the lesbian, gay, bisexual community, often communities of color, including black and Latino communities, have struggled.
Robert Harrison agrees. He's an HIV intervention specialist with Public Health, Dayton and Montgomery County.
But we would like to start recognizing the issues that are present in the black community and see if we can encourage, as well as other minorities, to come out and test. And for anyone that has put themselves at risk for HIV, they should seek out a test to know their status as opposed to waiting for some potential symptoms to appear, because they may not appear.
More stats from the CDC. They estimate one of every 16 black men and one of every 32 black women will be diagnosed with HIV at some point in their lives, and HIV/AIDS remains the third leading cause of death among black men and women 35 to 44 years old in the United States. Officials we spoke with say those sobering statistics are the reason for awareness days, and Public Health Dayton and Montgomery County have a list of testing sites online at phdmc.org. Governor Kasich has released his two-year state budget, and among the highlights are a 20% income tax cut for Ohioans, a 50% cut to small businesses, which he plans to finance through a higher sales tax on some goods and services and on oil and gas drillers. We're learning more details about his $15.1 billion education funding plan, and the governor wants to expand Medicaid to more Ohioans. All of this has political implications, and to talk with WISO News Director about all this, Bill Hirsch Hershey, who has covered Ohio politics for many years. He believes Governor Kasich will lock horns with fellow Republicans on the Medicaid issue.
I think in some ways, politically, Governor Kasich will relish this, because this Governor Kasich is sort of straddling the middle of the road and trying to. His tax policies are real supply side, I would say, hard conservative, shifting things from the income tax to the sales tax. But his proposal to expand Medicaid, that's something that Democrats think is a good idea. Middle-of-the-road Ohioans. And this will show Governor Kasich is kind of a centrist, looking to do good things, not just for his conservative and business allies, but for poor and working class Ohioans. And I think he will sort of relish this. And he says he's not going to deny his state the money that from the federal government it should be getting. I think overall it's going to benefit Governor Kasich.
Now, what about his education funding plan? We're still learning a lot of details there, but how is this being, how will this work out politically for Kasich?
Right now, it's not working out very well. The school superintendents from across the state who were briefed by Governor Kasich about this several days ago and were told that they'd be happy that districts that have low property values and have trouble raising their own funds would get more. Well, they say this isn't how it has worked out. Analysis that I saw, and I think it's pretty mainstream, is that 60% of the school districts, including poor districts in Appalachia and some other parts of the states, are not going to get any more money. And some of the people who praised Governor Kasich's proposal after meeting with him are now saying they were misled. But this is just the beginning of the budget process. And many of Governor Kasich's allies in the legislature, which, let's remember, the Republicans have a hammerlock on this. They can do whatever they want if they can come to agreement. They're not wanting to pour lots more money into schools. But we'll have to see how it works out. This is just the beginning.
I want to touch briefly on the sales tax plan. A liberal study came out that said that this wasn't fair. What are the political implications here?
I don't think we know yet. But I think that liberals clearly ultimately don't like this, because it shifts the burden from the progressive income tax to the sales tax, which affects all Ohioans, middle-income, low-income Ohioans. And when Governor Kasich first outlined what he was going to do, he made it sound like the expansion of the sales tax to cover many services wouldn't really touch on that many services. But when it came out, just about everything would be taxed. Governor Kasich's sales tax expansion would even tax bowling, which is pretty broad-based. And the study that you referenced was from Policy Matters Ohio. This is a progressive liberal think tank up in Cleveland, and they have determined that when you combine the sales tax proposal with the income tax changes, that the top 1% of Ohioans would get a $10,000 tax cut, but the average increase for the lowest 20% of Ohioans would be $63. So their conclusion is it favors the rich. Governor Kasich would say it favors the job creators.
What are the chances of this passing? Can we expect a lot of changes to this budget?
There will be changes. The Republicans will want to put their own imprint on the budget. But these are major changes in tax policy, and I don't think we can say for certain that they'll be passed exactly the way Governor Kasich has proposed them. We haven't really had a chance to talk much about another key part of his budget, which is increasing the fracking tax, and a lot of the money from that, that's for drilling oil and gas, would go to finance other parts of his tax changes. And the oil and gas lobby in Ohio and Columbus is pretty strong and has the ear of many of these Republican legislators. So it's far too early to say that this will pass just as Governor Kasich has proposed it, or even mostly as Governor Kasich has proposed it. But Governor Kasich has shown a good ability to use the bully pulpit. So we can expect to hear a lot from him over the next few months.
I've been speaking with Bill Hershey. Thanks for being here today.
It's good to talk with you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. The Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association, or OFA, is a statewide grassroots nonprofit group that was founded in the late 90s. Farmers, gardeners, and folks who were thinking about the kinds of foods they were growing and eating began working together to create and promote a sustainable and healthful food and farming system. On February 16th and 17th, Granville, Ohio, in the heart of the state, will be home to OFA's 34th annual conference, Growing Opportunities, Cultivating Change. It's Ohio's largest sustainable agriculture conference, an event which draws more than 1,000 attendees from across Ohio and the Midwest. Keynote speaker at the conference is attorney, rancher, and writer Nicolette Hahn-Nyman. We'll speak with her in just a moment. First, a little bit about OFA and the conference from Renee Hunt. She is the education director at the Ohio Food and Farm Association.
Well, what I like to say about OFA is, the local food movement is popular and trendy now, but back 34 years ago, our founders, this is what they had envisioned for people to be able to connect with their food source, to be promoting and accessing ecologically raised food. And back in that day, that was seen as extreme or a radical viewpoint. And so we feel like we've come full circle as an organization.
Let's talk a little bit about the conference.
Our conference will feature two keynote speakers, almost 100 workshops, so everything from field crops to gardening, from livestock to energy, marketing to in the home, business and health, policy, consumer, sustainable foundations, community. So there's really something for anybody who's interested in food and farming. We have a trade show. We offer a conference for kids so parents can go and network and learn while kids have an educational experience themselves. And we try to source as much local and organic foods for our meals as possible and even try to have a little fun on Saturday evening.
Do you think that's key to programs like the Food and Farm Association getting through to young people?
Yeah, our board feels that's really important because they're going to either carry on and expand the efforts that have been laid down so far. So we have a good mix of students who show up, both younger ones as well as high school and college students.
Renee Hunt is the education director at the Ohio Food and Farm Association. Anyone interested in finding out more about the organization or who want to raise their own awareness about food and farming issues can find out more at oeffa.org. One of the keynote speakers at this year's conference is Nicolette Hahn-Nyman. She's an attorney and rancher who writes and speaks about improving food and farming systems. She spoke to us by phone from her home in Northern California. Now, at the conference, you'll be exploring links between modern industrial agriculture and the public health and environmental problems we're facing today. Can you point out some of those links for us?
Yeah, well, interestingly, a lot of the food policy that we've had and the farming policy we've had in the United States in the last 50 to 100 years has been geared towards trying to produce more food and trying to produce it more cheaply. And that's actually led to a situation where we're doing a lot of overproduction of a lot of foods in this country today. And at the same time, we have, and we're actually overproducing a lot of the kinds of foods that are not very healthy. And at the same time, we have an obesity epidemic in this country. Two-thirds of Americans are now either overweight or obese. And the number of obese children has tripled in the last couple of decades. So we're kind of working at cross purposes in our food and farming policy and our public health situation.
It seems to me and others, I think, that our food system is somewhat tenuous. If something goes wrong, if any link in the chain breaks, there are going to be a lot of people looking for a food source.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, in some ways, our food system is viewed as being much more efficient nowadays. It's much more centralized. It's much more automated. Things are much more connected. And it's true that has, in some ways, improved the food system. But in other ways, the centralization and the consolidation, the lack of kind of dispersed food supplies all around the country, has led to a much more vulnerable food system. And we've seen that examples of this in these massive food recalls. So there will be a contamination problem, let's say, in a peanut butter plant in somewhere in the Southeast, And all of a sudden you have people getting very sick all over the country because of the fact that one single source is producing food that's spreading all over the country through our distribution systems. And it's similarly, you know, just the way we're raising animals, for example, we're rather than having small herds and flocks on lots of different farms around the countryside, we have huge operations. You know, in a chicken operation now, for example, a typical chicken operation will have over 1 million chickens, and especially egg-laying hen operations are really huge. And so if you get a contaminant in those, and it's very hard to prevent diseases and viral bacteria, virulent bacteria from being in those environments because they are very densely crowded, they're very conducive to disease and the spread of disease. And so you're much more vulnerable. That whole entire flock is more likely to get sick, and then that food is being dispersed all over the country. So in some ways, our system is stronger than it has ever been, and in some ways, it's weaker than it's ever been.
You mentioned that some foods were being overproduced with regard to our diet and obesity. Can you give us some examples of those food types?
Well, in the talk that I'm going to be giving, I'm going to show how our consumption of certain foods that are very definitely tied to the obesity problem has dramatically risen. And one example of that, I mean, a really obvious example is sugar. So we eat about 60% more sugar now than we did 100 years ago every day on a daily basis. And grain, just in the last couple of decades, we've actually increased our grain consumption by almost 50%. So grains and sugars, which are actually from a metabolic standpoint, they're pretty similar. Those are two things we've dramatically increased our consumption of. And our production in this country has continued to rise over the 20th century, and it's very definitely contributing to the obesity epidemic. So one of the things that is kind of ironic about our food policy is like USDA produces this the food pyramid, sort of recommendations of how we should eat. And even though a lot of people would argue, you know, take issue with some of the ways they've structured that, if you just accept it for the sake of argument and say, okay, this is how we should be eating, the U.S. does not produce enough of the foods on that pyramid for people to eat in a healthy way. Our USDA recommends how we should eat, but we don't match it up in our production, so especially fruits and vegetables, for example. If Americans ate the amount of recommended fruits and vegetables on their USDA pyramid, we would not have nearly enough fruit and vegetables for Americans to eat. So it's kind of a strange situation. Our farming policy does not match up to our nutritional recommendations to Americans.
Your speech at the conference will be titled Eating as We Farm and Farming as We Eat. And I guess taking the industrialized food chain out of the system, what choices do people have? What do you recommend for people who get their meals daily from the grocery store counters?
One thing I wrote a book called Righteous Pork Chop, and the book is actually kind of my whole journey through this food system, learning about it both as an environmental lawyer and then as an individual consumer. I found myself that when I started looking at what I was eating and just, you know, trying to tackle a little bit of it at a time, that I was able to dramatically change the way I ate, you know, over the last decade, really. And one thing I started trying to do was say, okay, I'm going to try to make sure that the eggs I purchase are not coming from these giant factory farms where all the hens are kept in battery cages and, you know, there are 1 million hens in a building and that sort of thing. And so I began looking at the labels on the egg boxes. And I began, you know, trying to make sure that they were being raised in places that I was comfortable with. And the eggs were kind of the first thing that I tried to change. And eventually, I got to the point where I was able to buy eggs from, you know, a local person who was producing, had the hens out on grass and, you know, really producing a really healthful, delicious, and, in my view, safer product. But that didn't happen overnight. It took me a while to get to that point. What I encourage people to do is one step at a time, just try to improve.
Do you think the industrial and environmental problems going on with the food culture today, do you think they're insurmountable?
No, actually, it's funny because my work has been a lot of writing and speaking about, you know, all the bad news. And so it can get kind of depressing for me and for people who are listening to it. But I always, spend at least the second half of, my talks or my articles, I try to always talk about sort of the optimism that I actually have and because of the good news that I'm seeing. And especially, I've really, from traveling around the country this last 10 years, I have been really, truly astonished by what is happening in all the regions I've traveled in, which is really kind of all over the U.S., with younger people especially getting really interested in food and in farming even, trying to start their own farms, trying to get land to farm. I've met young people all over the country that are starting restaurants that are trying to buy directly from farms. I've met lots of people, parents especially, mothers, that are very, very involved in the school lunch programs, trying to improve what children are eating in schools and how that's purchased and how that's prepared. And just there are just so many exciting things happening sort of at the grassroots level all over the country. And, being a Midwesterner myself, I'm originally from Michigan, I'm back there quite often. I'm amazed at how much different the situation is now than 20 years ago, and really for the better. So there's a lot to be concerned about, but there's also a lot of reason for optimism. And I do think from an individual consumer standpoint, there is a great deal more available now than there was, just even 10 years ago. If you're trying to eat better, if you're trying to get food from a better source today, it's much easier than it was 10 years ago.
Do you have any information specifically aimed at, say, our listeners here in Ohio? Any trends that are happening here in the state that you've noticed with your travels?
Well, my husband is the founder of a natural meat company that is a network of traditional smaller scale farmers all over the country. And we've worked with a lot of farmers in the Midwest and including in Ohio. And we've been very heartened by what we've seen there as far as the number of farmers that are interested in smaller scale farming and raising dairy cows, chickens, and pigs out on grass. So I think there's a lot very exciting happening in Ohio as far as sort of a rebirth in interest in sort of traditional farming practices that produce really high-quality food. So I have not been to Ohio in a couple of years, but I have a feeling that it's much easier for a consumer today if they go to a farmer's market or a co-op or even just a natural food store, to sort of get locally produced high-quality pasture-based animal products.
We've been speaking with attorney, rancher, writer Nicolette Hahn Nyman. She will be the featured keynote speaker at the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association's 34th annual conference, Growing Opportunities, Cultivating Change. It takes place Sunday, February 17th in Granville, Ohio. Nicolette, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. 55 years ago, on February 8th, 1958, WYSO began broadcasting. General Manager Nina Ellis takes us back in time.
It was students who did all the work to get the station ready. After many years of unlicensed, unofficial broadcasting on the campus of Antioch College, WYSO went on the air with 19 watts of power. They gathered expectantly on the second floor of the Student Union building in their new studios, and at 8 o'clock, Bruce Johansson, script in hand, stepped up to the microphone.
Good evening. At this time, Antioch College begins its first official transmission on FM. This is station WYSO. Owned and operated by Antioch College, Yellow Springs, Ohio, with studios and transmitter on the campus of Antioch College, operating on a frequency of 91.5 megacycles by authority of the Federal Communications Commission. For its first program, the Antioch Broadcasting System will bring you the official opening and formal dedication of its facilities in the Antioch Union.
At first, they were on the air for just 4 hours a day, playing classical music, jazz, news, and information programs about books and local education issues. In their first program guide, they said, "We wish to emphasize that this will be a community radio station." And now, 55 years later, it is still that. All this year, we'll be celebrating our anniversary by playing audio from our digital archives. And starting today, you can see an illustrated timeline about the station's history with photographs, press clippings, audio, and video at our website, wyso.org. Here's a little tidbit from the 1970s. It's Dave Gordon and friends with the WISO fight song. For WYSO, I'm Nina Ellis.
Well, if your radio's tired and you think you've had enough of the warmed-over rock and the disco stuff, then grab that dial, start tuning it around. Start tuning in an alternative sound, 91.3.
91.3.
91.3.
91.3.
Let me tell you that there isn't any better way to go than stereo WYSO.
The WYSO Illustrated History Timeline is on our website, and once you get there, you can send us your memories and photographs as well at WYSO.org. Reinvention Stories is a multimedia storytelling project that asks the question, how does a city of inventors reinvent itself? This week, we meet Oronde Clark. Clark got into trouble as a young man in Troy, Ohio. After spending time in prison, he turned his life around, and with the help of Dayton Social Programs, he started his own business, Clark's Enterprise. Reinvention producers spoke with him at his home in South Park.
I come from the other side of the street. You know, I've done a lot of dirt. I had a good, very good upbringing, brought up in the church, but chose to live in the streets and run the street life. And by the time I turned 18, I was headed to the penitentiary for aggravated felonious assault and numerous drug sales. And it was just, it was all bad. And I'm originally from Troy, Ohio, Miami County. And I'm the same guy that I was there, just they had no programs, no one reached out to help. When you're at the rock bottom or when you get told no, you can't, you can't, you can't. That right there, how you respond to that whole you can't, how you respond to that defines you. Anyways, I went and did that little time. I did 3.5 years or 4 years at 19. Got out when I was like 20-some. And when I got out, I kind of dibble-dabbled. Never been back to prison, but I kind of dibble-dabbled back in the streets because I didn't have a, really didn't know how else to operate or to make ends meet. Didn't really even know another way to think. But thanks be to God, I started thinking different. I started wanting things different. My desires start changing, my motivation. Some people call it growing up and maturing. And I just really believe it was God giving me a hunger for something else. So time started to change with the depression. Seemed like all the chaos and the jobs, losing the jobs and all that just started to happen. While that was happening, I was being blessed. Work was just there for me. God just began to bless, and I wasn't making much, cutting grass, and was able to clean out houses. I knew we was going through a hard time, so I was willing, hey, I don't care how big your yard is, I'll cut it for $12-$13 if I could just get 100 yards for that much. And then I ran into Mr. Dalton, the public works supervisor in Trotwood, and he knew I was trying to run a business, and he just told me more or less quit playing with it and gave me some direction and then led me to HRC, Human Relations Council, downtown Dayton. They helped me get what certification, what paperwork I needed, and I needed to be mentored. I needed that guidance, you know, and they gave me that and just helped me to get on my feet. You know, and one thing they didn't do was play with me. You know, they didn't tolerate no BS, no nothing. If this is what you want and this is what you're trying to do, we're here to help you. Miss Marcy Wright at the Human, God bless her, God bless her. I love her so much. She was the one told me that when you work, you get on your feet, you work, you, your business is flourishing, you're hiring people. This all, this is helping the city. This is, that's when I'm succeeding. When you're succeeding, this is what makes us all succeed. We do a lot of remodeling houses, from painting to drywall. You got a hole in the floor, replacing the floor tile. From residential to commercial to janitorial to construction, whatever it is you may need. And, you know, it didn't happen overnight. but it is possible. I know because I'm living proof to make it through and make it through hard times, you know, if you just keep pushing. I love Dayton. Dayton has helped me, shaped me, helped mold me in more ways than one.
Since this interview, Clark has moved from South Park to Trotwood. He still operates Clark Enterprise, but he says business is slow. This reinvention story was produced by Chandra Jones, Steve Bognar, and Sarah Buckingham. To see a short film, visit WISO.org. Reinvention Stories is brought to you by WYSO and Local Lore, a national initiative produced by AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio Incorporated, in collaboration with ZEGA, with financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.